HBpodcraft.com.
Thus, to my intense relief, it was arranged that Major Blenkinsop should accompany us back to Climping Manor in a semi-official capacity. And it was a proof that Scotland Yard did not regard me as a hopeless lunatic or a weaver of wild fantasies. Now, had it turned out otherwise, I had had the fullest intention of acting upon my own responsibility and taking the risk, so convinced was I that I was right, and that this grave danger not only to sleepy Sussex, but to Great Britain in general, must be extirpated at all costs. Under such circumstances, however, there would at least have been the fullest inquiries and much unpleasant publicity throughout the length and breadth of the world, if no worse consequences. Whereas now I was hopeful that, skillfully managed, it might be hushed up by official consent in the public interest, a thing by no means unknown in certain cases.
You know, if you're dealing with some kind of a werewolf situation and you want to keep things hushed up, maybe writing a 3-part novel with all of the details included isn't the best strategy.
Yeah, you've got a point there.
I think I do.
And those details that you're talking about are from the story The Door of the Unreal by Gerald Biss, and those lines that you heard at the beginning were from part 3 of it.
It's the third and final part of the book, and we're not allowing this cover-up that he's discussing to continue.
No.
We're going to tell you all the facts in the thrilling conclusion of this story. No details spared.
H.P. Lovecraft first made us aware of this book, and that is why we're covering it here on the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast.
At hbpodcraft.com. I am Chad Pfeiffer.
And I'm Chris Lackey, and our reader, again, is Anthony Stodesco.
Woohoo!
I just found out that his wife is expecting their second child.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if that was a phone call conception.
Well, after hearing him read for 2 weeks, I think a lot of people in our audience are expecting Anthony's children now. So congratulations to Susie, and also yes. Congratulations to everybody else who's been impregnated by this man.
I want to do a recap, but like, you know, seriously, who hasn't listened to the other 2 episodes? Your subscribers.
I mean, it would be foolish just to tune into the 3rd episode.
Yeah.
I mean, that would be like going to see Taken 3 without seeing the first 2. You just would not know what was going on. In all honesty, Heather said, "Do you want to go see Taken 3? And I haven't seen the second one, and I told her no.
Because you hadn't seen the second
yeah,
one?
Yeah, yeah. And we made that joke, but I kind of meant it. I was like, I at least need to know what happened in the second one. I assume it's the exact same plot, but
I'm sure somebody was taken and then he had to go rescue them.
Well, thanks for spoiling it.
I haven't seen any of them. I just assume that's what the movie's about.
Well, okay, real quickly, what's been going on?
Lincoln, an American, thinks his buddy, Burgess, who's an English guy, has a guy living next to him that is a werewolf.
Right.
This guy's name is Professor Wolf, and he has a daughter that seems like he's trying to turn her into a werewolf. The next full moon is coming up, which is also Walpurgisnacht. Lincoln has teamed up with his supernatural hunter slash lawyer buddy Manders and Blenkinsop, who is a police officer of Scotland Yard.
Yes.
They are going to stake out Professor Wolf's house on the night of the full moon and shoot any wolves they see. Now, they haven't told Burgess that they're doing this yet because he has the hots for the soon-to-be wolf girl, daughter of the wolf guy. Her name's Dorothy. Okay?
Yep.
And that's where we're at.
Perfect. Great summary.
So we're in the third and final part of the novel, which is called The Dower House in the Hollow.
And it starts with a lunch scene. What a surprise. Lincoln, Manders, and Blenkinsop are together. They have cold chicken and ham, some bread and cheese, tankards of beer. This meal was so good that here we are talking about 100 years later.
Wow.
I thought, you know, we were saying before Biss was kind of a big guy, so maybe that's why he goes into detail on all these meals. But also maybe he's doing something narratively. He's trying to make the reader hungry so that you can feel how werewolves feel.
Could be. So they decide to invite themselves over to Climping Manor, which is Burgess's house, and he lives there with his sister, Anne.
Right, that's going to be their headquarters for the operation that they're going to undertake in the end. And also is the true horror of the novel. I mean, Burgess has never-ending house guests in this book.
He really does.
Yeah.
So on the drive down to London, they discuss who they want in their shooting squad.
And when they're doing this drive, by the way, they do a ton of speeding. We've got the car stuff comes in again. There's speed traps all the way along the road, but Blenkinsop flashes his badge, and that gets them through. They keep getting stopped. He flashes the badge. They go through. I think top speeds on those cars or 1919 were probably 40, 45 miles an hour.
Which, you know, compared to a horse and carriage, it's pretty darn fast.
Yeah, that probably would have been pretty stunning. But they're all going top speed in this whole book.
When they arrive, they find out that Tony, the werewolf victim from previously, mm-hmm. he's better, but he wants to see his friend, so they're going to come down for a visit. We get some more flirting with Lincoln, our narrator, and Anne, who is, again, Burgess's sister.
Yeah.
But this time it's more than flirting. He says to her, "You're a saucy little minx, my dear Anne," I said solemnly. Which is funny that he says that solemnly.
Yeah, how do you say "you're a saucy little minx" solemnly?
I don't know.
In my head, you only say it like Austin Powers, or you don't say it at all.
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense. "And could do with a good spanking at times, as well as a mere lecture. Your brother is too fond and gentle to you. Now, if I were your brother..." Creepy?
Yeah. I mean, the spanking thing is, I can deal with that. That's good flirtation right there. But then why does he have to throw in, "if I were your brother"? What?
Yeah. Where is that coming from?
That's like 50 Shades of Grey. "I'm going to take you into my secret room. Before we go in, let's pretend we have the same last name." Wait a minute, what?
Wait, that's what we're doing? That's not what I signed up for. So he finally goes to Burgess and he tells him that it's time to talk. Lincoln's been keeping it from his buddy the whole time.
He's finally going to reveal things to him, although they have dinner coming up. As soon as dinner's over, he's going to reveal all of the things to him. And right before dinner, he says, "Hey, what's wrong with the Bronx before dinner?" Mander says that, actually. Mander says, "Good scheme, let's do it." So everybody has a drink. But they do this several times where they go, "Hey, there's nothing wrong with having a few drinks before lunch or dinner or breakfast." And I was just curious what a Bronx was, because I have you ever heard of that drink before?
No, what is it?
It's basically a martini with some orange juice in it. I think there's different cocktails named for all the boroughs in New York. So a Manhattan would be what's most familiar to
people. Right, yeah.
But usually they're just a martini with something added to them. But when I looked it up, I found it interesting that a Bronx was actually the first drink of Bill W., who's the founder of Alcoholics Anonymous. So the fact that they keep, "Hey, what's wrong with having a few drinks before dinner?" Well, you're going to find out eventually.
what's wrong with having a few drinks before having a few drinks?
Yeah, exactly. Well, they do a bunch of drinking. They wait for Anne to go to bed. She says as she's leaving, "Well, it's time all good little girls were in bed. I will leave you to your business." It's funny because she keeps joking around like, "Aha, look at what a little child I am." You know, the way she makes her 11-year-old face at Lincoln.
Yeah.
All of these things. And they joke about it. And then they treat her exactly like a child. So what's the joke?
I don't think it's much of a joke.
Yeah, go to bed right now.
Come on, we got men talk to do.
So they have their men talk finally with Burgess.
They sit down, have some booze, tell Burgess what's going on, and that Dorothy is involved. That's why they kept him out of the loop, because they know how he felt about her.
Mm-hmm.
They're pretty confident that the professor and Anna, who is the ex-nanny, are full-on werewolves, but Dorothy isn't, at least yet, a werewolf.
Right.
So Burgess, after a bit of discussion, believes them, and he's on board.
Yeah, and after so many conversations keeping him in the dark, you'd think that for the reader it would finally be a relief, but this scene is so belabored, it feels like we've seen it before. You know, obviously they did all of their explanation for Scotland Yard, now they do it again for Burgess.
Yeah.
And this is going to happen a few more times, so it gets a little boring.
So chapter 3, it's just Lincoln and Burgess talking outside now. Lincoln goes into more detail what he believes about the professor and Anna, that they're trying to turn her into a werewolf, and that she probably doesn't even know that they're doing this to her.
Mm.
Hopefully they can get to her before she is changed by killing them. If they kill these two werewolves, he hopes that it will interrupt the werewolf progression process, whatever that may be.
Because they're the ones that are giving her the flower and doing these things that are turning her. But he's making a lot of assumptions. I know that Lincoln is supposed to know a ton about lycanthropy and everything, but it's a pet peeve of mine in horror when there's that moment where somebody explains all the rules and then they are absolutely right. Because he really doesn't have a lot of evidence. He says, "I know there are two types of lycanthropy. There's inherited and there's acquired." And his evidence for why she's becoming a werewolf is a little slim. He notices that her physical appearance is changing. She's been wearing those flowers. The most damning piece of evidence is that she used to like chocolate, and now she doesn't.
Oh, the horror.
Well, at that point, I hoped that Lincoln was wrong and that it would be the opposite, that Dorothy is actually in control of all of it and she's just playing them.
Yeah.
And somehow the professor and Anna are just rubes that she throws out.
I was
out
kind
there.
Of hoping for a twist like that myself.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, no, it's exactly as everything is mapped out. So chapter 4, they go over the plan in a bit more detail. They are going to kill any wolves they see on sight. No wounding. Make sure they're dead. Unless there are 3 wolves. In that case, the smallest one should only be wounded. Because they think that'll be Dorothy. And they think that even if she changes, there might be a way to bring her back. Lincoln thinks this. Lincoln has some insane knowledge about the occult. Like, yeah. You think he's got just a bit of an understanding, but by the end of the story, you realize he's like a full-on sorcerer.
He is, yeah. He knows what to do. And you would think with all that knowledge, he would have a better plan than shoot the third wolf in the foot.
Yeah.
That part of the plan seems pretty dumb. I mean, even being a really good marksman in the dark, to be able to hit a wolf's foot?
Yeah.
And only wound it, by the way, not blow the whole leg off, but only be able to wound it. That seems, I mean, first of all, what if he hits the wrong wolf?
Yeah.
Just because it's the smallest, you never know. I mean, who knows what the, well, obviously Lincoln knows all the rules, but I would just assume the werewolves could look anyway. I mean, who knows what they're going
to
look like?
Can you just trust Lincoln? Because he seems to know everything.
Well, Burgess does, and he says, hey, I'm on foot duty. If someone's going to shoot my love, it's going to be me.
Of course.
And this is all, of course, very similar to Dracula. Once again, you know, Mina, Dracula made her drink some of his blood, and she was cursed. Mm-hmm. She had that mark on her forehead, and so they all needed to stop Dracula before she went full vampire. So it's very similar to that.
Yeah. So they get out some maps, and they start making specific plans. Some guys show up. Now, these guys that show up are Tony's friends from before, and they were around when his accident happened or when they were attacked. They're coming to see him, but they're thinking, hey, I know that these guys are good shots, so let's see if we can bring them in to our task and if they're going to help us out. Now, they show up in a fancy car, and they talk about the fancy car for a bit because Biss is a car enthusiast. And, of course, the guys are up for the job. Harry, Tony's buddy, goes in to check on him, and Tony looks pretty rough.
Yeah, and he also finally asks about Waffles and what had happened. Earlier, Lincoln was talking about that. He made reference to her disappearance, and he says, you know, Tony, he probably wasn't as into her as the press was letting on. I think that he was probably over the relationship and just didn't know how to tell her. So her disappearance is something that we really don't have to worry about that much, you know? And then also when they come up to talk to Tony here, they tell him that Waffles is dead. I thought, wait, how do they know that? She just disappeared. What if she's locked up in the house right now? Maybe they can make her into a werewolf if they're starting a werewolf cult. I mean, there's all kinds of other things they might be after,
right?
Especially if he was just found in a ditch somewhere. I mean, who knows what could have gone wrong?
This is one of the things with the writing of this story. Lincoln's not wrong about anything ever.
No, never.
That's not very interesting.
So, I know. But as I was reading it, knowing that Lincoln wasn't wrong, I was still entertaining myself by thinking, ah, poor Waffles.
Anyway, chapter 7. Dorothy shows up for a visit. She's looking pretty rough as well. Lincoln asks what's wrong, and she says she hasn't been sleeping well. She's been having strange dreams.
Yeah.
And her father's been acting extra weird, kind of like a caged animal.
He's been making her sleep with the window open so that gradually waxing moon can shine in on her. I'm sure she's also has her hair arranged on the bed just so as the moonlight covers her. But of course, with the bright moon shining through the room, she's having a hard time sleeping.
Chapter 8. That night, the men talk. Lincoln tells Burgess that he thinks that she's already wolfy, but it will be up to them to save her. Lincoln says that he knows stuff about curing a person of werewolfedness. So he also drops kind of a bombshell on him as well at this point. He goes, yeah, by the way, we're going to have to burn down Dower House. And he's like, what? That's my ancestral home, man. He goes,
yeah, it's been there forever.
He goes, sorry, dude, it's been corrupted by evil. And to make sure the evil's gone, you got to torch the place. He's like, oh, gosh, I guess if we got to get rid of the evil, we got to get rid of the evil. And he says, also, it'll give us a cover story for the deaths of the professor and Anna. There's a fire. They die in the fire. You know, nobody's going to be any the wiser.
Of course, they'll also be burning Waffles alive since she's locked in the basement. But they're not too worried about that.
Burgess isn't happy about it, but he agrees.
He has to, because if it says, Lincoln, of course, knows, if there's even a single bone left behind of these guys, it can retain the elemental. These werewolves are, they have much more of a supernatural bent. It's not really a physical disease, even though it can be passed on through heredity. It's some kind of elemental animal spirit that attaches itself to the person.
Mm-hmm.
So these plans are all laid out. Lincoln gets out the map. They do a little scouting around the Dower House. It's all preparation. In the next few chapters, there's not a whole lot that happens.
We get a bit of flirting with Anne and Tony this time.
It's become clear that they're going to be the lovebirds.
Right.
It's not going to be Lincoln and her.
No.
When they're doing this casing of the joint, they pretend to be sort of studying the grounds, but they're really just lining up where they're going to be when they shoot. Mm-hmm. There's also this great line in one of the chapters. Anne makes Lincoln take a walk because she says he's been eating too much and taking no exercise.
Mm-hmm.
His response, I am not a lover of what people call exercise simply for the sake of exercise. It is too much like an out-of-doors imposition to my mental point of view. To some folk, it has become a positive fetish or a form of self-immolation in this age of extremes from vice to virtue. I don't know if that's Biss's point of view coming across, but
it sure seems to be.
Yeah, what? You're going to make me exercise? Ah, what a waste of time. But I like that he's saying, you know, I think it's this extreme, like when people pursue it, they're pursuing it too much.
Right.
People are too obsessed with it. It becomes this fetishistic kind of thing. And that had a modern touch to it as well, you know?
Yeah, I could see some people definitely are like that. And other people also fall on the other end of the spectrum and don't exercise enough.
Right, like myself.
Myself included. Chapter 10, Burgess gets his servants in on the tasks.
Yeah, they're going to have all of their roles to play in keeping this under wraps. And everybody involved in the Enterprise takes an oath of secrecy. There's an interesting end of that chapter that's yet another, I think, of Biss's comments in the story. Because he's thinking all these, you know, these lower class guys are pretty great.
Yeah.
They're really making it happen. They're really getting on board with the team. Mm-hmm. He says, I could not help wondering why England did not move quickly, more generally, and more generously to recognize the material to hand in modern democracy as we do across the Atlantic. Someday circumstances will arise in the cycle of history, and she will, to her own eternal advantage. So despite some of the, you know, all of this upper class nonsense in the whole thing, Biss comes in with this very, maybe we should be recognizing the merits of the lower classes.
Right.
It's an interesting commentary out of nowhere, because there's not a lot of stuff like that in this book.
In chapter 11, the guys go out for a little shooting practice, and then finally in chapter 12, it's Tuesday. This is the day. Auspicious knock. Very exciting. But first, some last-minute planning and some more rifle practice.
Ah, I thought we were here, finally.
Chapter 13, it's 8:30 at night, and they have dinner. Everyone is tense, waiting for the confrontation. After their meal, they go out at night. The whole lot of them, they're ready. Everything's going to be enacted. Blenkinsop, Burgess, and Lincoln are covering the front of the house, while Hedges, Burgess's manservant, is taking Manders, Willingham, and Verjoyce to the back of the house. It's clear, very tense mood. They take their positions.
They wait there a long time. It's a hunt, you know. It's very stressful. They're checking the time. As it gets close to midnight,
they hear the front door click open.
And then, yes. Oh, I had been right in my bizarre theory. No fantasy, after all, of an ill-balanced mind. Out of this black fissure issued a great gray male wolf, with the low swinging stride of his species, clearly visible in the brightness of the moonlight. I dropped to one knee and covered the ill-omened brute with my rifle. And then I felt a constriction in my throat, and the veins on my temples knotted, as instinctively I wondered how poor old Burgess must be feeling. After the great gray male followed a smaller gray female wolf. And I knew that our worst fears were realities, and that the last crowning touch of hell's spite had been put to this piece of devil's work. Dorothy had metamorphosed.
And after these two come out, they're followed by a gaunt, brown, old she-wolf, which is clearly Anna. And the two big wolves form up around the smaller wolf, so they're kind of a nice little family there.
Yeah.
Things almost go bad, because there's a split second as they're walking out of the house where Professor Wolf-Wolf senses something's up.
Yeah.
Kind of sniffs the air, huh? But it's too late. Blenkinsop, what does he do? Blows a whistle.
Boom. Blenkin fires, and he drops the large male.
Mm-hmm.
Two shots ring out almost simultaneously right after that. The big she-wolf drops and the smaller female yelps, a human-like yelp, and then limps into the front. I gotta say, it was cool that it just happened like this, but it was also kind of a letdown. I was hoping for a more dramatic fight.
Yeah.
But this kind of really, to me, felt like a role-playing game, because it has that sense of realism to it where they have a plan, it's a solid plan, and they know what they're doing. So odds are they're going to be successful. These wolves don't have any surprises, like, and I thought maybe it would be like, oh, you need silver bullets or something like that. No.
Yeah.
Just shoot them. And he does. They shoot him, and then that's it.
I agree. I mean, everything went to plan, and Lincoln was right about everything. And in story, at least storytelling that, you know, we're used to, this is the climax of the story. Everything's been leading up to this moment. Usually, in the three-act structures that we're used to, that's when things fall apart. The original plan doesn't work.
Right.
You make a plan, you think it's going to work, and then it doesn't. And so then everybody has to get together and figure out another way. And usually, whatever the main character needed to learn over the course of the story, that's when that learning comes into play. And they're able to conquer the villainous forces. So it's funny, but things going right is the last thing that we would expect in a story.
So it was kind of refreshing, but it was also kind of a letdown.
Yeah.
They run to the house. Anna is still in wolf form, but she's dead.
Right.
But the professor, he's not dead. He's still alive. They describe him, which is a little creepy here, A terrible, monstrous object. A man's body, naked but hairy, with the head of a wolf and the feet of a wolf. Not yet dead, but writhing as though in a ghastly convulsion.
It's that mid-transformation thing.
Yeah.
Very cool. I was so glad that we got to see that, too, because...
You don't get that very often.
Definitely werewolvery, because now we've seen the demonic transformation
right
halfway through, so we know it's true.
Now, when Lincoln approaches it, it snarls and it tries to bite him, and it almost gets him. But Lincoln pulls out his pistol and just shoots him in the heart. Mm-hmm. And that's it. He's dead.
And he loves killing him, too.
He really gets excited about it.
He has no remorse about it. He feels this good feeling when he pulls the trigger. Which, I think, from the film Fright Night, the original, similar situation. When Roddy McDowell stakes Evil Ed, and he's halfway through the transformation. And he's dying. Look at Roddy McDowell's face. He's so sad for him.
Yeah, he is.
He feels awful that he had to do this to a creature.
Yeah.
Here... None of that kind of kindness.
He loves it.
Lincoln's a stone-cold occultist killer. Well, Fright Night is a good example of any kind of modern storytelling with what we were just talking about, too, because I think they go into the house in the end with a plan that immediately falls apart.
Well, their plan's bad.
Well, their plan's bad, but but at the end, everything falls apart, there's a struggle, and then they have to pull out another plan somehow.
Yeah.
They have to come up with something to do. This story needs some kind of irony, I felt. That's my biggest complaint about it.
I feel like this was really trying to strive for is the sense of realism.
Yes.
And usually in life, it's not necessarily any irony. Things just happen.
You're totally right. We read that Biss described his writing style just as that. Even talking about something supernatural, he tries to keep it kind of almost like a crime story. And that's how these things unfold.
So anyway, back to the story. Burgess runs into the stairs at the house to see what was going on ahead of Lincoln. Lincoln follows him after he kills Professor Wolf. He runs in, sees Burgess holding Dorothy. She's in human form and she's wrapped in his coat and she's unconscious.
Says the wound is a mere trifle in her left foot. Which, what was he shooting with? Like a BB gun? I mean, this is a point where there could have been some irony. I think it would have been really funny if he'd blown off her face or part of her leg. And then when she comes to, they're like, we rescued you. He goes, yeah, but I'm not marrying her.
Oh.
Like, remember Middletoe of the Right Foot? He, like, found out his wife had that one little thing wrong and was, like, not interested.
That's not the case. It's just a minor wound. I was thinking either he grazed her or maybe she had some kind of resilience because she was a werewolf.
I'm impressed that he could hit a wolf in the foot.
From a distance. It's pretty amazing.
I don't believe it.
They leave to take her back to Burgess's place, and then a bunch of dudes show up to burn the place down. Chapter 15, as they're driving back to the house, Burgess is cradling Dorothy. She comes to a bed and she sees Burgess, and then she snuggles up to him and then goes back to sleep. So it's like she's also into him, and that's the first real indication that we have of that. When they come in, Anne greets them, and she's like, whoa, what the heck is going on here? And then Burgess just shuts her down. He's so mean. He just goes, all explanations afterwards. Ask none and give none, but look after my darling for me. And he just hands her over. That's it.
Well, he's been getting treated that way by Lincoln for the whole book, so now he's happy to cut somebody else out. He's just passing on.
He should have learned how bad he felt, because he was kept out of it.
Yeah, and I wonder if they ever do tell Anne exactly what went down. I think they tell her, we'll give you some hint of it later, but I doubt they really told her much.
Well, she's a woman.
Women don't understand werewolves.
Chapter 16, the house was soaked in gasoline and the bodies were thrown on pyres. They find in the old side barn human bones and a woman's watch engraved Wuffles.
Which is all buried by Scotland Yard. They don't
know.
As much as they would have liked to present this evidence, they burn all that stuff as well. I think they find evidence of the other missing couple from the very beginning.
Yeah they do.
They also pull up all the flowers. Those lycanthropus flowers, and they burn those.
Well, they don't set it to burn. They just get it all ready. They get it prepped. And then Burgess is the one that actually has to set the fire.
Right.
Because one, it's his house and his responsibility. But also, if for whatever reason he was like, I didn't agree to any of this. They're like, you were the one that burned your house down. You have to take responsibility for it because it's your flipping house.
You're going to shoot your wife and you're going to burn your house down.
Chapter 17, Dorothy's bandaged up. She doesn't really remember anything at first about the whole night. She talks about how they had no meals that day and they were really hungry, acting strange. She drops the bomb that Wolf was not her real biological father, but her stepfather.
He never would let her tell anybody that he was her stepfather. I have to admit that despite there were clues dropped throughout this book about that,
right.
The fact that she didn't look Teutonic, she didn't look anything like them, et cetera, et cetera. I still didn't quite realize that. Or that she wasn't around when there were all the stories of them in Eastern Europe getting run out by the peasants. She wasn't with them.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Obviously, it's because she's not really the daughter. He had sent her off to boarding school while they were doing those things. But it's all pretty tidy now. She's not actually even related to these guys. So we don't have to worry about their curse being passed on, their German curse.
Her real father died when she was a baby and her mother remarried. Her mom was really unhappy during the marriage and she died. Dorothy hated him. She hated Professor Wolf and Anna. But he was controlling. I mean, he had like crazy hypno powers.
Yeah, she says, my mother acted very strange. I think he might have even hypnotized her into marriage.
What's good about this is that she's not a werewolf by werewolf blood, so it's possible to exorcise her.
So it's not just if we shoot her in the foot while she's in wolf form, she'll be better. There's more they have to do. Because there was ritualistic stuff that happened to get her into this state. She talks about how her father made her dip her hands and face in that special water. She had to wear a wolfskin belt that day.
Yeah.
Everything that we've talked about before and during Werewolf History Month, he drew a circle on the ground, he made her stand in it, chanted this weird incantation, sprinkled her with this potion, and it was all the stuff it's named in there. It had to be in that Elliot O'Donnell werewolf source material.
Right. Yeah.
But after they had done all that, it says, out of the half-darkness there rose a tall, pillar-like phantom, and then she goes unconscious. So she was possessed by an actual wolf spirit of some kind.
Yeah.
In that moment.
They tell her that Professor and Anna are both dead, and she replies, thank God. So Burgess and Lincoln leave her to recuperate a bit, and Burgess just blurts out, I shall marry her, of course. I'm like, what? Maybe you should ask her? I don't know. See how she's feeling about it?
Well, yeah, but nobody's going to want her. He's going to say, will you marry me? She says, I'm not sure if I want to do that. He goes, I guess I could just tell everybody you're from a werewolf family. I mean... Guess I could just go do that.
Chapter 18, Lincoln has a lot of planning to do. He goes out, has to figure out all his werewolf exorcism stuff.
He's got to get that prepared, but they do have a cocktail before they do that.
Of course they do.
It says it won't do either of us any harm before lunch. It's getting earlier and earlier in the day.
He waits until it's a good day when the stars are aligned and he makes all the preparations. Lincoln goes to Burgess's house, picks him up and Dorothy as well, drive out to the woods. And he gets some full-on wizard stuff going. Like I was saying earlier, he draws a 7-foot circle and then an inner circle within that one, builds like this little wood altar, builds a fire, puts a pot above the fire. Then he puts in some sulfur and some opium and a bunch of things I've never heard of before.
Yeah, camphor and a mandrake root, a live serpent.
Fungus, all this stuff.
And she's wearing some gown and he like ties her up.
He splashes her with this concoction he makes and then he puts the rest of it in the circle. And then she cries out and freaks out all exorcist style, you know, like a possessed woman would. And then this gray cloud shape comes out of her and then it just passes into the sky.
Cool. And all pretty pagan stuff, too. I mean, yeah. I imagine that these guys profess to be Christians, but everything that just happened seems a little off-brand to me, man.
Oh, yeah. That's not in the Bible. So part 19, a week later, Dorothy and Burgess are married. Mm-hmm. Lincoln was the best man.
Yeah.
And this is the real end and true story of the appalling mysteries of the Brighton Road. Still unrevealed so far as the public are concerned, and by now they have written them off in their short memories amongst the many undiscovered crimes chucked up against Scotland Yard, which is not always so much to blame as they think. Now my task is finished, thank heaven. This manuscript, by the unanimous will of all concerned, is to be placed in the custody of the British Museum, and not to be available to the general public for a century, until all the actors in the ghoulish drama are dead and forgotten. Then the whole horrible truth can be revealed to those curious enough to dig up a tragedy a century old. Postscriptum. I may be allowed to add that the future of Tony Bullingdon and Anne has in the meanwhile solved itself upon lines I had foreseen for some time. Love, I often think, has a great deal to thank environment for. And certainly it is opportunity which makes the lover, as well as the thief.
That's the end.
That's it.
We've talked a lot about this story, so I don't think there's much more to say. It was fun to read.
Yeah.
Upon closer examination, it's a pretty stupid story.
Yes, but I would recommend it. If you're a fan of the... I mean, obviously, people who listen to the show are fans of this stuff. I would recommend it, even though it's not that deep of a story.
Yeah, no.
Take some time with it, because it's longer than what we normally cover.
Yeah.
Speaking of which, we've been talking about what we wanted to do for next month, and we brought it up so much in these last three episodes, because... Door of the Unreal is clearly a Dracula knockoff.
Sure.
We thought, well, since it is March, last year we did Marches for Draculas.
Let's do Dracula.
Yeah, let's do Marches for Dracula singular.
So we're going to spend the whole month talking about Dracula.
We have never covered a book that long before. We're going to keep it top level. So normally we go through a synopsis of these stories for the listeners because you probably haven't read them. This one is something that everybody's familiar with. So while we'll cover some details about what happens in the book, we're really going to talk more about the themes. And what I'm interested in is, what are the weird elements of Dracula?
Right.
It's such an influence on Lovecraft, and it has been brought up time and time and time again ever since we started this show 5 years ago. So it probably is about time we get to that original thing. And also, I haven't read it. I don't know when you read it last, but I haven't read it since like
high school,
junior high. Yeah, it was a long time ago for me, and I loved it. But how will it revisit? I know that some people as adults have read it and not cared for it as much. We talked about that when we had Leslie Klinger on the show.
We did, yeah. Mm-hmm.
We've also got some other guests who might want to come on and discuss Dracula with us. So it should be a fun month.
We've got this fella, Alucard, that's going to maybe come on. He is an expert on Dracula.
I was thinking of bringing on a guest as a doctor I know, Dr. Acula.
Really?
Yeah, he's been very interested in meeting both of us.
This Mr. Alucard, he wanted to meet both of us in person.
Really?
At night. In Transylvania.
This is Dr. Acula I've been talking to. He's been talking about buying some property up by you.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, well, I just bought a house this last year, so I can offer him some advice.
Oh, cool, yeah. He'll probably move up in next door to you.
So that's it for Werewolf History Month. I'm glad we actually had a real werewolf story.
Good stuff. I want to thank Anthony Tedesco for doing our readings the last 3 weeks. Fantastic.
Did a great job, and for all the horsing around we say about him, he's a great guy and a good friend. So thanks, Anthony.
Thanks and congratulations.
And with that, I'm Chris Lackey.
I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And you've been listening to the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast. H.P. Lovecraft.